All right, everybody, you heard the classroom bell. That means it is exactly 7 p.m. Eastern time on Wednesday night, and that means it's time for Mass Office Hours. I am joining in from a lovely, lush meadow tonight, and I'm joined by the good Dr. Mike Zordos. Mike, how are we doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Eric. It's awesome to be here. Looking forward to this show. You know, a little sad because our U8 baseball season has ended. We lost in the second round of the playoffs, but that's okay. On to basketball season now, and we'll see if we can bring home the all-important summer U8 basketball title.
Summer basketball?
Summer basketball. It's indoors, which is good in South Florida.
Yeah. Man, they must have just said, like, well, we got to have some sport, but we cannot be outside, so we'll just move basketball.
You know, if you recall, Dr. Truxler, last year, you were a financier of this basketball team.
Correct.
That's right. It was a Mass Research Review sponsored Cooper City, Florida youth basketball team. It's a true story. We made the playoffs. We were pretty good. We were pretty good. So we have to, I'll tell you what, the financiers, though, Dr. Truxler, Dr. Helms, and Dr. Colenso Semple, they're pretty tough. They asked a lot about wins and losses. I thought they were going to give some motivational speeches to the team that they sponsored, but it was more of, I think I even saw you smack the snacks out of a kid's hand when he missed a free throw and we lost.
Well, it wasn't because he missed a free throw. It's because he was not good. I mean, like, you know, because we've had some of our good kids who I like who miss free throws from time to time. They usually shoot 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10. But he was really weighing down the team and letting his teammates down. So sometimes in the state of Florida, it's okay to strike children when they're not playing well, is what I hear.
I think that's frowned upon, even in Florida.
Okay.
It is even in Florida, I think that's frowned upon. So okay. I would advise staying away from that.
I retract my statement. Do not strike children in any state. Just to be on the safe side, because there's some annoying litigious people out there like Mike Zordos.
All kidding aside, though, the Mass Research Review did sponsor that basketball team. It was a great time. The kids loved it and appreciated it. Mass got them some warm-ups to wear, and they had a fun season, so we'll do it again.
Awesome. Good stuff. Now, Mike, we got plenty to cover tonight. I first want to thank everyone who was part of our big anniversary sale, 7th anniversary sale. We've got some new faces in the Mass community, so folks, don't be strangers. We'll see you in the Facebook group. We'll see you in the live chat when we're on YouTube. Thanks to all the new folks who are joining us in Mass World. If you like what we're doing here, Mass Office Hours, of course, subscribing to the Mass Research Review is the number one way to support what we're doing. Mass is what makes this whole thing happen. But there are other ways to support as well. You can like, rate, subscribe, review for Mass Office Hours. You can tell a friend, share a link. You can join us live and submit questions in the live chat, or you can submit questions after hours using the link that is in our episode description right now, and that's at massresearchreview.com/officehours. Now, Mike, to kick us off here, before we get into some questions in the live chat, I want to begin by addressing the controversy. Okay, and you know me. I am constantly fighting people online, constantly stirring up trouble, generating controversy everywhere I go, and unsurprisingly, I have stepped in it once again. So if you follow the Mass Research Review Instagram account, which you should, we put some good content on there, Instagram at Mass Research Review, I posted something a few days ago, and the face in the image, if you look at our profile, it was not me. It was one Dr. Andrew Huberman. So there's a whole saga behind this Instagram post. Several months ago, there was a paper on cold baths or on ice baths and cold showers that I reviewed in the Mass Research Review. Mike, I know you remember it because that's one of the few areas where we've actually overlapped in very different ways. But you've done a lot of ice bath stuff as it pertains to recovery in Mass. So I know you at least skimmed that one with a high level of interest, saw the direction I was going and said, oh, never mind, it's not about recovery. But I was looking more into kind of this new wave of ice baths, right? Because, Mike, you know, ice baths, for as long as football has had two-a-days in July, people have been doing ice baths, right? And it's always between the morning practice and the afternoon or evening practice. You get in there, and frankly, it's kind of refreshing. May or may not help with recovery. I leave that to you, Mike. I know my lane that I stay in. But nowadays, people are doing ice baths for all sorts of stuff. You know, it's gotten really, really popular. People say it is, you know, good for their mental health, anxiety-related outcomes, you know, focus, cognition, losing fat or staying lean. I mean, people are making all sorts of claims about all these different things that ice baths and cold showers are doing for them. So the study came out, we reviewed it in the Mass Research Review, and back when it came out several months ago, I'm not going to lie, Mike, I said it was pretty bad. I basically, and you can kind of go back and read it if you're a subscriber, I said, hey, folks, you may enjoy ice baths, and that's okay, but this study is not as good as people are saying. You know, it seemed on the surface, maybe, to lend some support to the idea of doing ice baths for, you know, both kind of psychological outcomes and for, you know, belly fat related outcomes. But there were just a tremendous number of issues with the study that really, to be completely honest, they jumped off the page, Mike. I mean, you probably remember vaguely the review, but the statistical tests were wrong. The vast majority of the tests were non-significant. It was not an overwhelming slam dunk in favor of ice baths and cold showers. And if you dug a little bit beneath the surface, there are just some really peculiar characteristics of this study. And very quickly, a number of science communicators all kind of independently seized on it and said, this paper is really weird. You know, pump the brakes. It may not be reliable data. Now, at the time when it came out, Andrew Huberman's got a huge podcast, got a huge following on the internet. He talked about the study on at least four occasions pretty favorably and said, like, hey, this is good stuff. I'm not going to put words in his mouth with the hypothetical quotes, but basically reviewed the paper quite favorably and essentially cited it as evidence, like, yeah, this ice bath and cold shower stuff is pretty good, like I've been saying. So that message that this study provided, you know, reliable, relatively strong support for ice baths and cold showers through just that channel, a couple podcast episodes, couple Twitter threads, you could estimate that it reached probably about 5 or 6 million people. I think that 5 million is definitely on the low end there. The only reason it's hard to guess, I mean, you can look at the Twitter views and the YouTube views, but you don't know exactly how much overlap there is where the same, you know, if 5 million people saw it here and 1 million people saw it here, maybe half of those people saw it in both places. You get the idea. It doesn't really matter. 5 million and 6 million, you know what those have in common, Mike? It's a large number, especially when you're talking about human beings seeing a piece of content. So the reason this matters is because this paper recently got retracted, right? And so I revisited the topic in the most recent issue of Mass. It was actually our cover story. And I talked about this paper again. And you might be wondering, why not just let it lie? Why bring this up again, right? Because my initial review, like I said, was quite skeptical, quite negative. And there is a couple reasons that I really wanted to bring this up, because I thought it was a really important lesson when it comes to interpreting and communicating science. And a lot of the folks who read Mass are doing one or both of those things on a regular basis. So first of all, I was interested in showing people that retraction is a really inadequate mechanism on its own. Retraction only works if science communicators enthusiastically share the news of the retraction as well. And so in my article, I mentioned that it's just tremendously lopsided when you look at, you know, this original message about this study, sharing the findings in a fairly uncritical manner that reached, like I said, 5-6 million people. At the time I was writing this article, the abstract of the retraction notice had been viewed fewer than 700 times. And the full text of the retraction notice was under, I think, under 900 views at that time. So basically, we've got 5 or 6 million people hearing the initial message, and like 1,000 eventually hearing, actually, never mind, right? So that's just the numbers there are really not great. And so one of the reasons I wanted to kind of dig back into this is to show those numbers and quantitatively describe why this is a problem, and also kind of show people an example, you know, out in the real world in the fitness industry of, you know, look at these 5 or 6 million people who will go on, you know, 99% of them the rest of their days thinking that they are following the science when they parrot some of these claims related to this paper, never knowing that those claims ended up being so unreliable that they were actually retracted. Now, that's not very controversial, but nonetheless, some folks on Instagram were in the comments and it got, I didn't think it was too chippy, but there were certainly some folks who were like, hey, why are you naming names? Like, why am I looking at Andrew Huberman here? Why are you showing clips from his original episode? And I actually think this was an instance where, in a totally non-malicious way, it's useful to actually put a name and a face to it. Because, first of all, I think for retractions to be useful, we kind of need a call to action for high-profile creators to correct the record. Like I said, if you spread the word to 6 million people and you later find out that that evidence was unreliable, I think there should be a call to action to say, well, the best person to reach those same 5 or 6 million people is actually you, you know, because they're tapped into your content pipeline. I also thought it was important to show people in a very specific instance that unreliable information can come from unexpected places, right? So it's not always the obvious clickbait ads and videos on YouTube and terrible articles that are like, hey, three vegetables to blast belly fat. Like, you might actually find unreliable information in places where you expected to find extremely reliable, evidence-based, science-backed information. And so I think it's important to remind people that just because folks with PhDs are talking, present company excluded, Mike, that doesn't mean you should necessarily let your guard down and say, oh, I'm sure that everything coming in here has been filtered extremely meticulously and I can take it straight to the bank. And then the third reason that I think it's useful to mention this on office hours is I think that this little exercise, for some people, kind of held up a mirror for them in a way, Mike. And what I mean by that is there are some folks that when we posted this, I thought it was a completely respectful video of just here were the claims. Hey, folks, turns out that this paper actually got retracted. And check out my article that goes into more detail about how to make sure that, you know, that you have some defenses against running into stuff like this again, where you get misled by unreliable papers. So anyway, I thought it was a, you know, pretty tame, pretty respectful video. I don't think it was a call out necessarily. But the reason I say it kind of held up a mirror is because there were some folks in the comments who were like pretty upset and kind of like acting like it was a total cheap shot to critically discuss content that a person published on purpose. And Mike, a little anecdote here. The first time I ever published research, it was when paleo was huge. And my undergrad thesis was slightly, ever so slightly critical of the paleo diet.
Oh.
And I was like, I don't know, 21 at the time. And I remember it was my first time doing research. I was kind of nervous. We'll see if people like it. I hope they like me. And I literally read a blog post about it that said, I wouldn't trust Eric Trexler to take out my trash, let alone do science. And that
I'm Googling this blog post right now.
It might still be up.
Yeah.
I can't imagine there are too many Google hits about me taking out garbage.
I wouldn't let Eric Trexler take out my trash.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm doing that.
I don't think you're going to get like 7 pages worth of hits. But anyway, all of that is to say, you know, when that happened, I kind of made my code for life, which was that if you don't want your work or your opinions criticized, there's a foolproof way to do that, Mike. You just keep them to yourself, right? But once you hit send, once you make a video, once you make an article, once you publish a paper, it's out there. It's fair game for respectful criticism, right? You know, it doesn't mean that you open yourself up to all sorts of cheap shots about whether or not you're qualified to take out bloggers' garbage. But nonetheless, I really don't think it's a cheap shot to critique someone's work. That is why we publish ideas, is to put them out there and have people play with them, so to speak. But anyway, holding up a mirror, there were folks, and I would say just in the more general sense, if you are super upset that someone has shared a totally respectful article or video of your favorite content creator providing information that turns out to be unreliable, you might want to check up on that because it probably means that your admiration for this content creator is getting in the way of your ability to objectively assess the information that's being provided. In other words, you have become more of a fan than someone who is critically consuming content and filtering it and really exercising some skepticism. So it's kind of just a little warning that if you find yourself in that situation, you might be letting your guard down a little bit and you might want to reflect on that a tiny bit. But anyway, Mike, that is the update on the tremendous controversy. But the reason I bring it up is, Mike, I think we have that article for free on the website. Is that right?
We do.
Yeah.
We have it for free on the website. If you go to massresearchreview.com and you go to articles, you go to resources, and then under the dropdown, articles and videos, it'll be the first article that is up there. So it's on massresearchreview.com, one of our most recent posts, and it's there for you right now. You can go ahead and read the full article.
Awesome. So folks, if you want to hear what all the buzz is about, all the controversy, check out that article in full and see if you think that I am an altruistic sharer of information or a very malicious person who is just sniping popular fitness people.
Before we go to another question, I have something very important to report, which is that I found a blog, highfatnutrition.blogpost.com.
Okay.
And I can't find that exact line, but it is about your thesis. They link to your thesis.
Yeah.
And there is a line here that says the thesis reports pre and post diet lipids, but only gives end of paleo diet food breakdown and only the fat saturated fat at that. Go figure. Guess they forgot to ask what folks were eating to have better lipids than their study diet was going to produce. Perhaps they had a defective crystal ball. So,
wow.
You know, I think there's a lot you need to answer for here in this.
I know. It turns out that when I was 20 years old, I was not a fully baked scientific producing machine, you know. Turns out that I had some things to learn during the old master's and PhD and beyond, by the way, because you come out of your PhD thinking, oh, now I'm a fully formed scientist. I hope not. You got a lot more to learn.
I also now have the whole thesis up. I'll spare people me reading any excerpts from this, but get ready, folks, because I think the next post on massresearchreview.com will be me critiquing Eric Trexler's thesis. So I'll make sure to do a special episode of Office Hours when that comes out.
Yeah. I'm sure at this point that I would not be thrilled to even have my master's thesis critiqued. So the idea of my undergrad thesis being critiqued, why don't you go ahead and just email that to me? I don't think we need that going out to the whole world.
Sounds good.
Yeah. But Mike, I think now is probably a good time to dive into the live chat and see if we have any questions percolating in there.
Let's go.
This first one, I don't know if you've had some time to think about this, but Art was asking, totally on theme, and he actually posted this before we started talking. What fitness or nutrition or health or lifestyle recommendation have you made in the past that you wish you could retract?
Well, we know yours. You wouldn't recommend anybody read your thesis anymore. We know that. You know, this is tough. I'm trying to remember all the stupid things I've said over the years, and I don't think they can all come to me. However, I'll say this. In 2008, when I first got into research, and the area that I was interested in was very specific, and it was concurrent training. And the reason was because I was running long distances, running marathons at the time, and lifting weights, doing powerlifting meets all at the same time. And I would tell anybody who wanted to listen that even minimal cardio was a terrible idea. And I was very adamant that you should avoid it. The interference effect, it is a real thing, but I was adamant at the time that it didn't take that much of a dosage to induce some of it, and that it was something to be feared. Whereas now, I've been very outspoken, I'd say, over the past few years that, yes, the interference effect exists, but it's actually quite easy to avoid. And we shouldn't fear it. Cardio is fantastic for our health. It's not really going to impair gains unless the dosage is very, very high and we're not structuring it appropriately. So that's certainly something, the first thing that comes to mind that I was very strong on in one way. And I think I was 22 years old at the time and just getting into research. Definitely have come to understand that principle considerably more. In general, I'm a lot less rigid with a lot of training structures. Understanding things, I guess, aside the concurrent training is a very specific one. But outside of that, and in so many mass articles, I talk about this, is I'm really just on the trying to grasp things conceptually rather than A is better than B and B is better than C, because even if a study shows that, it's under what circumstances and for who. And so getting to understand things conceptually more than looking at, you know, this versus this. So the specific one, I would say, would be my concurrent training stance. The second one is more of a conceptual one there. But I'm sure there's a lot more art, and I'll keep thinking about my failures. And as they come to me, I'll bring them up throughout the show.
Yeah, it'd probably be easier if we just like took some time and we went through each other's failures, you know, kind of digging through like mid-2000s YouTube and trying to really dig into stuff. But I would say for me, I did, like, here's the deal. When you're an up-and-coming fitness person, content creator, like, you have to, like, enter this space, right? I remember when I was, like, transitioning from, I guess it was probably at the end of my undergrad, right? I was not equipped to do my own in-depth literature review for every topic that people care about in fitness. So you kind of, you do enough research to say, here's a person that I trust who typically gets more right than wrong. And it seems like they have looked into this very deeply and they haven't led me astray too badly in the past. So I'm going to kind of outsource this and go with what they have concluded until I either gain the skills necessary to form my own evaluation, or if I already have those skills, until I get around to actually doing it myself, right? So I remember, like, when I was 20, 21, 22, there were a lot of things out there that I just wasn't really ready to kind of critically interpret myself, or I just didn't, I mean, I was young, I didn't have enough time yet to get around to all this stuff. You know, the nice thing about making fitness content for like 10 years straight is that you end up making a lot of different content. And at certain points, you have reasons to dig into carbohydrate loading, hydration, you know, protein. You start to kind of check all the boxes there. So all of that is to say, a lot of the stuff that I got real wrong early on was kind of considered the orthodox understanding in the evidence-based fitness world in terms of things like being really particular about protein timing. You know, a lot of us, I think, have revised our protein stance a little bit and said, okay, maybe you don't have to go that high, and maybe you don't have to have it perfectly distributed and maybe you don't necessarily need that many meals per day. And maybe it's okay if you have 2.4 grams of leucine in that meal or 2.1 instead of trying to get over like 3. So I think protein is an area where I've changed a lot. My views certainly on refeeds and diet breaks have really changed over time. And that's something that I'm quite proud of. You know, it's, I don't look back at that and cringe. You know, I feel like there was kind of an initial like mechanistic understanding and we said, hey, maybe these will work. And then, you know, people started to dig into it. There was a call for action. I was very happy to participate in some of the research in that area and I continue to. I got a study just getting rolling right now that I'm collaborating on that should shed more light on it. But, you know, I think those areas, not just diets, diet breaks and refeeds, but also reverse dieting, I think it has been a really interesting experience to watch that literature go from literally nothing to something where we actually are starting to say, you know what, I think I actually do have a decent idea of what these things can or can't do. So yeah, I think if you're in it for the science and you're interested in being a lifelong learner of fitness, it's almost kind of rewarding to watch your perspectives change over time because it means that you're growing, you're learning more, and you're developing a more refined understanding of these different topics, either because you've gotten smarter, you've built up your skill set with critiquing research, maybe brand new research, maybe you just literally didn't have the data to know the answer 15 years ago. You know, it's interesting to see, you know, all these different things that, that can combine to ultimately change our perspectives over time. So, yeah, I've been wrong about plenty. And the goal of any scientist is to get continuously less wrong over time. So, Mike, I'm seeing another good one here. And it is, we had one here about training frequency. And I'm going to kick this one to you to start with, because you are the training, you're in the training department. That's where your primary mass appointment is. Also appointed in the video department as well. Don't want to forget that. So the question, is it better to hit a muscle group 2 or 3 times per week? Does the ideal frequency change depending on whether you are bulking or cutting?
Yeah.
Mike, before you answer that, mm-hmm. That's another one where I've been wrong. And that was the only one I was going to share and then I forgot. I used to promote really aggressive bulking. That was a mistake. You probably don't need that many calories to build some muscle. So seeing the word bulking jarred into my memory, the just insane amount of food that I used to eat. And I remember going around telling people, and again, this is when I was like 20, but going around telling people, oh yeah, I mean, you're not going to gain an ounce of muscle unless you're eating, you know, 5,000 calories a day. And man, I didn't look great. I certainly didn't feel great. And it was just totally unnecessary. Anyway, Mike.
Yeah. So first, I'd appreciate if you note that I'm the chair of both of those departments.
Correct.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I applied for entry to the nutrition department on multiple occasions now. It's been rejected, but we're appealing the decision. So is it better to train 2 to 3 times a week? Does it matter? Should it change when you're bulking or cutting? So in a general sense, I would say that I don't think either of these matter in the sense that I don't really think it matters if you're doing a frequency of 2 to 3 times per week. I'll give some caveats, and I don't really think it needs to change if you're bulking or cutting. It might for practical reasons, which I can discuss. But in general, 2 to 3 times per week. So the literature that's out there suggests that 2 or 3 times per week, there's my first thumbs up of the night, is sufficient. And one doesn't really tend to be better than the other for a muscle growth or for strength perspective. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of difference there in the literature. Now, could more frequency perhaps be better than lower frequency? Sure, it's possible if there's a reason for it, meaning if that 3 times per week is allowing that person to perform more volume than the 2x per week. If they can get that same magnitude of volume in 2x per week, then I don't think there's going to be a difference. And the meta-analyses that are out there show that there isn't a difference between 2 and 3 times per week. I'm reviewing a paper. I'm almost done with the review for the June issue of Mass that's looking at a meta-analysis between split body and full body training programs. Now, the biggest difference in these training programs is the frequency. If somebody's doing a full body training program, what we're seeing in most of these is people are having a frequency of 3, 4, 5 times per week. If it's a split, it's usually 1, maybe 2 times per week. And off the top of my head, of the 14 studies in that meta-analysis, I believe only 4 showed even one outcome of the many outcomes in those studies to be different. And the only time that there was a difference for hypertrophy, or one of the only times, was when volume was not equated between the full and the split body, which I believe was between 5 times a week frequency and 1 time a week frequency. So from a muscle growth perspective, as long as the volume is there, you should be fine. Now, it may depend upon what you enjoy for training, in the sense that if you're going to have a higher frequency, it may be a bit more difficult to train to failure all of those times. If you enjoy training to failure, you may train with a little bit of a lower frequency, pack in some more volume on those days, and crush it to a 1, 2, or 0 RIR constantly. If you want to back off failure a little bit, maybe you spread it out a little bit more throughout the week, and you add a little bit more volume because you're staying farther from failure. So I don't think that's really going to matter too much. It also depends on how much time you have to train. Can you get all your volume in twice a week? Do you even want to go up to more sessions per week? Now, does it matter if you're bulking or cutting? Probably not for the direct reasons. Indirectly, if getting in the gym some more is going to help you, you know, have, depending on the type of training you're doing, maybe a bit more caloric expenditure. Maybe you can perform a little bit of a circuit that day. Maybe it helps to curb your appetite a little bit if you're really struggling not to eat when you're cutting. So perhaps there's some indirect reasons that you might alter that frequency. But for the most part, I don't think the frequency is a huge deal. Like practically, if you're trying to pack all of this volume in, you're increasing your volume over time and you're pretty well trained and you're like, oh, now I have to get 25 sets in for lower body. That's not going to happen in once a week, right? You're going to need to train more than that just from that practical perspective and from a time perspective. So as long as you can get all of the necessary volume in that you need, 2 or 3 times should be fine. I don't see that much of a difference. If you're training from a strength perspective, perhaps a little bit more practice on the lift could be beneficial for you as well. But even there, the literature doesn't seem to really lean heavily in favor of more frequency for strength, especially when volume is equated.
Yeah, I think it's really encouraging to see a lot of people getting very strong with very different training frequencies. You know, like outside of the research, you know, there are plenty of folks who have built up a tremendous base of strength training, even as low as once per week, right? And then you see, of course, the norm is to train each muscle group maybe 2 times a week or 3 times a week, and sometimes even more. And I think that kind of reinforces what the data show us, which is that it doesn't seem to be a tremendous impact of modulating frequency if you're doing adequate volume across the week. And when I say strength, I also mean muscularity. Like people get big and strong, train in a lot of different ways when it comes to training frequency. Mike, I got a question here that I'm going to take.
Let's go.
Got a question. Are there any benefits to taking hydrolyzed whey protein powder in comparison to regular whey protein powder? On a podcast, Dr. Bill Campbell talked about 2 studies that showed a benefit. Well, I tell you what you're not going to catch is me saying a single bad thing about Bill Campbell. I consider Bill to be a dear friend, a collaborator, colleague. I look up to Bill. He's a great guy, great scientist. So you're not going to get 2 controversies out of me in a week, Mike. Nice try. No, Bill's fantastic. I will say with hydrolyzed whey protein, when I boil it down and I think mechanistically about why it may be advantageous, I can only think of extremely, extremely specific scenarios where it might be advantageous, but it's really a stretch, in my opinion. Now, I wouldn't be shocked if there are studies out there showing a benefit specifically if they are looking at, for example, a very short time window looking at the effects of protein when the protein is consumed in isolation on an empty stomach after a prolonged overnight fast. At that point, we can see some differences, even small differences, in how rapidly these proteins are broken down, absorbed, and eventually do stuff in the body. So if you kind of create a study design where it's empty stomach, protein in isolation, and we're just going to look for like maybe a few hours at protein synthesis responses, it would not be unusual or unexpected from my perspective to see a slight advantage of hydrolyzed whey over regular whey, because hydrolyzed basically just means that before you ingest it, when it's sitting there in the tub, they've already gone in and done a process called hydrolysis, where they actually kind of chop up the protein into shorter peptide fragments before it's ingested. So it digests more quickly, it absorbs more quickly, and ultimately gets to the finish line a little quicker in terms of actually impacting muscle protein synthesis and related processes. Here's the problem. We rarely are consuming protein completely in isolation over a prolonged, after a prolonged overnight fast. And rarely do we actually care about what's happening in the first 3 hours after we consume protein. And so what we tend to find in the research that's been done on protein over especially the last 15 years or so is a lot of what we thought about protein and these kind of minute differences in how quickly they're absorbed and digested and so on, when we start to zoom out and say, okay, but forget about those 3 hours or 6 hours, let's look over 24 hours, a lot of those differences really wash away. And you have to keep in mind that most of the time when you're consuming your protein beverage, more often than not, it's not going to be in isolation in a completely fasted state. You might be mixing it in milk, which is a whole different type of protein that's going to be getting absorbed and digested at the same time. And then, of course, if it's not for breakfast, you're still probably digesting a decent amount of your breakfast. Helms always talks about the conga line of food that's kind of working its way down your digestive tract. So all that is to say, I think the devil's in the details in terms of whether or not any given study will find an advantage of hydrolyzed protein. But when it comes to practical outcomes and practical application, I personally would not use hydrolyzed whey protein because usually it's considerably more expensive and probably isn't going to give you much of a benefit. But I did say, Mike, when I was starting, that there is kind of a little caveat where you could construct a scenario where maybe for some reason you find that hydrolyzed protein is just better for your GI tract. You for whatever reason, you've tried plant-based proteins and they bother your stomach, and you've tried casein and you've tried regular whey, and because of when you consume it or just how your stomach works, if you tend to just digest it better and have less or fewer gastrointestinal symptoms, I'm not going to argue with you on that. Some people may find that. I've even talked to people who do really prolonged exercise bouts, and they they like to basically use hydrolyzed protein because they do need to get some protein in throughout the course of this really extended exercise period, and it's just a little bit easier for them to digest with everything going on with exercise. And that's common. When we're doing a lot of exercise, our body can't really devote enough blood flow and energy to really prioritizing super efficient digestion. So anything you can do there to kind of give your body a little help with digestion and absorption can sometimes be helpful and can attenuate GI discomfort. But man, that's a really unique use case. And for most applications, a vast, vast majority, I would just go with regular whey protein. Mike, we got a question I think I want to hear yours first. And this is really interesting. We've got two questions back to back from different people, and it's all about USF today. And that's right, a couple hours from you, Mike? You keep an eye on them?
Close by, see the questions, and I know both these folks fairly well, fans of both.
All right. Yeah. So we got a question. So Bill Campbell's at USF, right? And Sam Buckner joined there a handful of years back. He's, you know, right down the hallway from Bill. And the question is, can you speak to Sam Buckner, Dr. Buckner's research on our limited ability to gain muscle? Do you agree that our ability to gain muscle occurs within the first few months of training?
You know, I don't know exactly what Dr. Buckner has said on the topic, so I don't want to, you know, put words in his mouth or state what he said. But just as Dr. Trexler is a fan of Dr. Campbell, and so am I, I'm a big fan of Dr. Buckner, and I've known him for about 12 years now, a long time. And so in terms of, you know, our limited ability to gain muscle, and our ability to gain muscle mostly occurs within the first few months of training. First, I think that it's good that there's a discussion and a narrative that we can gain muscle early on in training, because for so long, if you go back to a lot of the old textbooks that are out there, you know, research would be conducted and it would be said that in the first 6 weeks or 12 weeks of training, all of the gains that we're seeing in this study are due to neuromuscular adaptations and it's not due to muscle hypertrophy. And I would always push back against that and say, even in the first few weeks of training, you're just not detecting hypertrophy by the methods that are being used in that study. It's not to say that hypertrophy isn't there, that muscle growth isn't occurring. It certainly is. It's not that you can detect it after 8 weeks and none of it occurred after 4 weeks. No, it was happening. You just hadn't been able to detect it yet. So I do think a lot of robust growth occurs. And I think the point, and again, not knowing exactly what Dr. Buckner said on the topic, but I think the point is really good in that you're going to see a pretty solid kind of leveling off or attenuation in the rate of muscle growth after a certain time. So not too long ago in Mass, I reviewed a study that was a multi-year study, I think maybe a five-year study out of James Steele's lab, another great that we all like around here. And over this, after about 30 weeks is when strength, not muscle growth, but strength tended to really be attenuated over the long term. So strength increased pretty rapidly over those 30 weeks. And then we saw an attenuation of that. That doesn't mean that strength didn't continue to go up. It did continue to increase, but the rate was so far lower than it was in those 30 weeks. And I think with hypertrophy, if somebody is training hard, we kind of see that as well. You're going to see somebody and they're going to get a lot bigger in those early stages of training if they're not doing anything. And then that rate is going to be attenuated. But that doesn't mean it still can't occur. And if you look at even some of the higher level bodybuilders over time, we're still seeing some progress, right? Take a look at our own Dr. Helms from his last shows to when he won his so well-earned WNBF pro card here. He was bigger. Bodybuilders that I've coached, and we can look at their size, they get bigger. Now, is it a lot? Is the average person going to notice that? No. So from a biological perspective for health or for most of us out there, is muscle growth really occurring to a meaningful extent with just kind of normal training in a person after a certain, you know, a number of years or amount of time? Probably not to a point that's really anything to write home about for a lot of folks. But for a lot of us in here that are interested in that small amount of muscle that is going to make a difference, we are still seeing this. And when we look into the research, when we have studies in trained individuals and they're over 12 weeks, we're seeing muscle growth in those studies. Now, some of those individuals aren't super well trained, but some are. And we are seeing muscle growth in those individuals. Now, a lot of times, the reason I think in, you know, and this is a point, this is a little bit outside of this topic, but if we all go through a training program, we know that we're not gaining a significant amount of hypertrophy, let's say every 8 weeks. But when you look at a study, almost every study that's being conducted, you're going to see this 5%, 8%, 10% increase in muscle growth over the course of this 8 week study. And I think that's the case because when individuals, mostly on a college campus, are recruited for this study, now they have structure. Now they're in a lab. Now they're probably training a little bit harder than they otherwise would have, and they're adhering to that training program. And we're seeing that increase in muscle growth in them. Whereas if they're just training on their own, even though they're going to the recreation center at the university and they're lifting weights, they're not seeing the same kind of structure that they would, or maybe the same kind of work rate or commitment that they're seeing in the lab. So I point out that you do see that growth in people when we have some of these studies that are in more trained individuals. So I guess my take homes would be there, without wanting to speak for anybody else, that in the early stages of training, if you were just to take, you know, the first year, a couple of years of training versus over the 10 years, would most of your muscle or a lot of your muscle be gained early on? Yes, absolutely. But muscle growth can still occur. It's just going to be attenuated. And you might need to have some pretty inventive changes of those variables over time to see that. And this is where this is the last point I'll make, Trek, so I know this is going long-winded, is that even though, let's say, a lot of the muscle growth occurs early on, but you can still see it later, albeit attenuated, is that I don't think we've fully fleshed out the best training approaches for muscle growth, because most of the research isn't geared toward that. It's geared toward training for strength. So I've talked a lot about volume cycling for muscle growth and these unconventional changes of these training variables. You know, I use the term periodization with a little bit of hesitancy, but just keep in mind that periodization can be defined as, you know, manipulating variables to peak at a certain time. That can be any type of manipulation. It doesn't have to mean decreasing volume and increasing frequency. So for hypertrophy over the long term, once we get into these more advanced stages, perhaps there's some designs or changes of these training variables that we haven't even explored yet. And I think that's probably likely, because research typically isn't designed for a training program to maximize muscle growth. It has been designed to maximize strength, with muscle growth then being looked at secondarily. And these studies are short term, 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks. So I think it's attenuated over time, but I think it occurs. And I think we need to improve our training practices in the literature to really realize some of these changes later on.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the big challenges with quantifying long-term muscle growth in the peer-reviewed research is that it's extremely hard to do a very long-term resistance training study. So that's one thing, is that there's not a tremendous amount of data. The second thing is, the most likely scenario when you are able to do a tremendously long-term resistance training study, it's going to be folks who at baseline are pretty untrained and are willing to hand over the next several years of their training to you. And you are probably talking about general population folks who are doing a nice but pretty like boilerplate training program, like kind of just the basics. Not a lot of variation to it, not a lot of really substantial progression to it. You know, these are not programs that are designed to take you from a beginner lifter and say, wow, now you're a bona fide intermediate lifter and we're going to start incorporating some more advanced elements. And you know what? Now you're advanced and we're going to crank it up another notch. It's kind of just like, here's a training program, do this for 3 years, let me know how it goes, right? And so obviously, it's not super surprising that general population folks who are not trying to become bodybuilders, who are doing a pretty stagnant program for a long period of time, what do you know, Mike, they plateau. Makes sense. Now, that doesn't mean that I reject the premise entirely, because I don't. I think that muscle growth is very likely, when you zoom out big time, to follow a fairly logarithmic pattern, right? Where you make your beginner gains, which is so common that we have a term for it. So obviously we acknowledge that your rate of growth at the beginning is the best you're ever going to have. No one talks about their second wave of intermediate gains that rivals their beginner gains. No, your beginner gains is where it's at. So we kind of already have baked in this idea that you have a rapid rate of growth, and then obviously that's going to taper. And we also have this other term that we all use, your genetic ceiling or your genetic limit, right? And we all kind of have a general understanding that once you're that advanced, you're pretty much not making a lot of growth, not a meaningful, measurable amount of growth. So we've already kind of built in, like, the mental model of how a lifting career goes if everything goes well, it's already logarithmic, right? It starts with this really rapid increase, and eventually once you reach as good as you can get, it's flat. And so then the question is, what happens between point A and point B on that logarithmic curve? That initial thing where you can do anything you want and you're going to make great gains, and then that ending asymptote, that totally flat plateau where you can do whatever you want and you're really not going to gain anything new. And I think if we had better longitudinal data, we would find that probably a large portion of how high you get before that plateau is dictated by luck of the draw, genetics, and just sticking with it for a long time, that combination of factors. But I think the kind of nonlinear peaks and valleys along the way in that curve is probably going to be dictated by thoughtfully approaching your diet, thoughtful manipulation of training variables, things like that. So I'm very hesitant to go straight to the limited literature that we have and say, this is the growth trajectory of someone who basically is obsessed with fitness, right? Like someone who like they go to bed excited about the fact that they get to train in the morning. I'm not comfortable saying, oh, your trajectory is going to overlay perfectly on that trajectory. I do think that there's some things we can do to make meaningful growth happen beyond that initial time frame that might look less plausible if you're just looking at general population data from the research in folks that are doing fairly generic and fairly stagnant programming.
Yeah, one thing to add on that, and that's really well said, but just more from the research perspective is, you know, and I got to give my current students credit. They have really highlighted this for me as because it's something we've discussed a lot, which is, I think the way for the literature to be able to answer these questions, even if it's obviously you would have to do this for 2-3 years, but even to just get longer studies in general, even if they're 16 weeks as opposed to 6 weeks, that's a big difference, is to do unsupervised training. Mm-hmm. And see, one of the biggest things, and again, my current PhD students, especially, so the one on this I want to talk about is Josh Pellant. He's done a great job of convincing me of this. He deserves a lot of credit. Is that when you do an unsupervised intervention, what you can do is you can get a lot more measurements. Because if you're doing a 20-week supervised intervention, it's a lot of time for these people to come to the lab, and there's breaks. They're usually university students, and there's a winter break and a spring break and whatever break and a fraternity party or whatever they do. I don't want to know what they do, but whatever it is that they do. And then when they're in the lab, there's only so much time. They're already giving all of this time. You really can only do pre and post measurements, maybe mid measurements. But when they're training for 20 weeks on their own, every 3-4 weeks, they can stop by the lab for 30 minutes. You can do another ultrasound measurement, send them on their way. And now you have this time course of measurements as well, which I think is really valuable. And now they've trained for a longer time. So it's not that all studies should be unsupervised. It depends on the question, what you're looking at. But in these longer term studies, I think more unsupervised studies would be helpful. And credit to Josh for really bringing that to my attention and convincing me of that over this past year. But I don't know how you feel about that, Trex, but I think that would help to get at some of this.
Yeah, I do think we need to get creative. I think we've kind of tapped out our ability to do essentially, for being honest, poorly funded, small, longitudinal, single lab studies with supervised training. I think it's just an inherently limited way to aggregate data. I think we need more multi-site trials. I think we need more studies where we're okay with unsupervised training. And I mean, there's a lot of technology that we could utilize to facilitate I would even call it like semi-supervised training, right? What time did you train today? You tell me, okay, well, you were wearing your Fitbit. I can see that your heart rate was elevated in the time range that you told me. Is that perfect? Of course not. But hey, you know, we've got some kind of biometric validation. Training happened today. You know, there's ways we can do this. I mean, if you really wanted to get, if you wanted to push even further, you know, you could then, depending on what kind of resources you have, and maybe if the market gets a little bit more affordable for some basic devices, do bar velocity. You know, if we're doing a bench press study and it's unsupervised, you know, at the very least, I want to see that your bar is moving up and down, right? It tells me a little bit more than your heart rate. So, yeah, I think there's some creativity that has yet to be tapped into, at least on a large scale for that type of work. Now, Mike, I'm thinking we should pivot here. First of all, if you're listening, folks, in the live chat, thanks so much for joining us. We love having you here. You make the show worth doing. Make sure you like the video right this second. I'll give you a second to find that thumbs up button. It looks like the gesture that always pops up on Mike's screen when he's talking. So make sure you like that video on YouTube. Also, drop in the chat where you're at. We've got someone joining in from, I think it was Santa Monica we had someone mention.
Santa Cruz, that's Tina. She's
Santa Cruz.
Been here a bunch. Tina, good to see you here again.
Yeah, so folks, let us know where you're chiming in from. We've got people all over the place. Someone said that I'm in Windows land based on this beautiful meadow. That sounds accurate. And someone said AI Trex powered by Windows 11 wasn't how I envisioned the future, but I'm all for it. That's how you know it's not AI, when I stumble over the word envisioned. I think AI would be able to tackle that pretty easily. All right, so Mike, little shift here. I want to go through rapid fire. I want to make sure that we maximize our time with the great Mike Zordos. So I'm going to shut up. I'm just going to feed you questions, and I'm hoping that we can get through several of them relatively quickly. And the idea is to keep this super practical. You know, don't need to go really into depth on the evidence. You know, might say, oh yeah, there's a study that did this and that. But let's make sure that we give the good people what they want and solve some problems. What do you think?
I think you just subtly, passive-aggressively told me to not be so long-winded.
No.
And I took the hint. I got my timer out, and I'm going to keep them all to 2 minutes.
All right. 2 minutes works. And some of them, I think, honestly, will be probably less than 2 minutes. But we'll see if you're up for that. All right. So, Magnus, probably not pronouncing that right. I'm seeing an accent, and I don't know what to do with it over the U. So, Magnus has a training program where they're supposed to train legs twice a week. First day, we're doing high bar squats, RDLs, Nordic curls, and reverse Nordic curls. So Magnus really likes that day, likes those exercises, progressing well. But sometimes they get so sore that they don't really feel recovered enough to do the second leg day. And so then they just kind of skip it and move on. And kind of alternate their leg days. So the question is, should I change the exercises or sets to be able to do both of those lower body sessions per week? Or, you know, should I just kind of keep doing what I'm doing?
So Magnus, I got my timer going here. So I think that what's going on here is you could have a couple things. It could be too much volume in general, although I don't think that's the case here. I think what's happening is the exercise selection, and that's causing the soreness. So if you have something like Nordic curls, right, you're talking about something that is almost always going to make you sore, right? Nordic curls, Romanian deadlifts, things like that, training through a long range of motion. So if you're training twice per week on the lower body, so I don't know what days of the week you're training here, but let's say you're training Monday, Thursday. What I would do is I would go ahead and move or shift the higher volume Nordic curls over to Thursday. And that way on Monday, if you're doing the squats, you're good to go. And then by the time you do those on Thursday, you have Friday, Saturday, Sunday off when you get back to Monday, and you should be able to train. I might take even that volume that you have if you're doing a lot of volume on Nordic curls, and then you can split it up between Monday and Thursday, and it shouldn't be as fatiguing. But generally, I would leave the exercise that's the most fatiguing for when you have the biggest break after that. So something like Monday, Thursday, put that most damaging exercise on Thursday, and I think you'll be good to go. If you find that that's still too much, then take that volume and split it up over those 2 days rather than doing all of that exercise in one day.
Good stuff, Mike. I know you planted someone in the live chat because we have a running question.
Here we go.
Can I make running progress on 2 times per week? Running frequency. Currently lift 4 times a week. I can only run early mornings on Saturday and Sunday. I live in Texas, don't want to run midday, presumably because of the heat. And then a sub question, is a treadmill an okay alternative to add on an additional day? So basically, is running twice a week, is that enough? And can I throw in some treadmill work to add in a third day there? Is it basically, what do you make of treadmill runs in comparison to more typical runs outside?
Got it. 85 seconds on the last one. We'll see what we can do here. So I very, very much appreciate that you want to run early in the morning and not midday. I also live in South Florida, where it's during the day already, it's into the 90s. So I also run very, very early in the morning at about 4 a.m. and it's still hot then. So can you make progress running twice a week? You could certainly make progress running twice a week, but it depends on where your levels are to start and what your goals are. If you're an elite runner and you're trying to make progress running twice a week, that's going to be difficult. You could potentially, if you're doing a lot of other cross training, maybe some miles on a trainer, something of that nature, but it doesn't sound like that's what's happening here. It sounds like you're doing, you're running twice a week and doing cardio here twice per week. So if you're starting a baseline, you can make progress twice per week. If you've already been running for a number of years, it's probably going to be a bit difficult. Now you're running on back-to-back days. I would probably do one workout and then one kind of decent run if you're really trying to make progress. So one sort of interval session, maybe a tempo run, which would be kind of around lactate threshold pace. And then maybe one run where you're getting in a bit longer. I would do the tempo run kind of, if you can, how much you can handle. You could do it as intervals, or you could do it, maybe a little longer, 5-6 miles at most. So you could make progress, but it would just depend upon, what kind of level you're at and what your goals are. If you want to be a really, really successful runner, it's not going to be enough over the long term. If you're just starting at baseline and you want to make some progress, you can do it, but it'll be difficult. And running on back-to-back days is going to be tough to get a ton of miles in, especially if you're not doing anything over the course of the rest of the week. Sorry, that one was longer.
No problem. I'm going to jump in with one here. The other Eric, who we prefer not to talk about, but it's okay. He was on RP the other day talking about various sizes of calorie surpluses when bulking. The comment here is that it sounded like the smallest one wouldn't even cover the extra energy needed to do the exercises. Something that's worth noting there is when you're talking about, how much energy you need to fuel a bulking phase, the energy cost of exercise actually gets a little bit tricky. First of all, it can be difficult to estimate in general, especially with resistance training. Sometimes our energy expenditure in resistance training isn't quite as high as we might otherwise think. I think generally a heuristic is about 6 calories per minute in a typical training session. But of course, that is a very rough estimate. Would look very, very different for like a circuit training program versus Olympic weightlifting versus bodybuilding. But you have to really sit down with the numbers to see if they make sense. And it can be really tricky to estimate the energy cost of lifting. And you also have to remember, when someone says, I'm going to introduce a surplus of 100 calories, if you're trying to say, well, does this whole training program cost 100 calories? What you really have to be thinking is, they were already doing resistance training at maintenance. And what they're talking about when they add extra calories is above and beyond what I had been consuming. So in many cases, when people are quantifying this, I don't know how Eric was presenting it there, Helms, how he was presenting it. But in many cases, people are already talking about their maintenance with, a basic resistance training plan in place. And they're talking about adding in calories above and beyond what they're currently maintaining on while training. So I know it can cause some confusion, and that's because energy cost estimates and calculations are really a pain in the butt, and they can get pretty complicated. Mike, a question here. This one's in your wheelhouse. Does cardio improve recovery from resistance training? For example, cycling the day after doing heavy squats.
So I love this question. It is something that I have been interested in for quite a long time, because I am on the record here on Mass Office Hours stating that I think recovery modalities in general are overrated. And it's not because they don't do anything at all, but it's because the benefits tend to be really, really small. A lot of these modalities are impractical. And if somebody always feels that they need a recovery modality, perhaps it's not the recovery modality they need. Perhaps they need to look at how they're structuring their training. Do they need to do less volume? Do they potentially need to move a damaging exercise like a Nordic curl, as we talked about? maybe to where they have a lot of rest after that before they come back, because that exercise always causes a lot of damage. So I've always been interested in low intensity cardio for recovery because it's going to increase blood flow. It's very practical. Somebody might go for a walk anyways. Somebody might jump on a cycle while they watch TV, do something else. So in volume 8, issue 1 of Mass, I reviewed a study from Arbiza et al. Titled Effect of Foam Rolling Recovery on Pain and Physical Capacity After Resistance Exercise, a Randomized Crossover Trial. This looked at foam rolling and cycling post-exercise, and I titled this article, Recovery Benefits of Foam Rolling and Cycling Are Small at Best. 20 minutes following a workout, individuals did some cycling, and there was a small attenuation of strength immediately following exercise, but there was no difference in the recovery of all of the outcome measures, which included muscle pain, isometric torque, range of motion, flexibility, all that. By 48 hours, there was no difference between just not training and doing cycling, and the benefits were really small. So I think that the recovery modalities of cycling or low intensity cardio could be small at best. And I would still say maybe you could include it because it's practical and because it's not going to cost anything. But to expect something monumental from this, I don't think is going to be the case. Although it just does kind of feel good to move around a little bit when you're really, really beat up. And that was kind of the origin of why I enjoyed it. Is there a ton of data out there saying you're going to get a huge boost? No, but maybe a small boost. There is one other study, and I reviewed this one in Mass too, looking at in-between exercises for lifting, doing really, really light intensity resistance training, like 10%, could actually help recovery as well. So just that movement in general, maybe a small benefit. It's practical. I like it, but don't expect anything huge.
Now, Mike, are you familiar with compensatory acceleration training?
I believe in terms of, you know, deliberately moving quickly. So if I'm correct, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, we could apply this in resistance training in a couple different ways. So one could just be to say, hey, we're going to want to move the concentric as fast as we can, which if you're training for strength, I think you should always do while keeping appropriate technique, right? If you're squatting, you're not looking to go up onto your toes or anything like that, but maximal intended acceleration. And then we could think of compensatory accelerated training in terms of like more of a what we might call a dynamic effort type of day, where we're saying we're going to put, you know, 40, 50, 60% on the barbell. Maybe there's some sort of other accommodating resistance on there. Maybe there's not. So this terms of power or explosive type training. So on the first one with heavier loads for strength, I think you should move as fast as you can. With those dynamic effort type workouts, you know, I think there's been a lot of debate. I don't know if I've heard too much of it lately, but probably in the years, probably around those years, if you were here for the beginning of the show where I was probably a bit off on the concurrent training phenomenon back in 2008, and Trex released his really harmful undergraduate thesis that we talked about. In those days, there was a lot of debate around dynamic effort training. And, you know, I reviewed a study in Mass in the early days, so about 7 years ago now, the pre-Trex times, where some individuals responded and improved rate of force development to power training and were explosive training with really light loads, and some individuals didn't. And whether that's an individual thing or not, it's hard to say. I don't know if I could say that I think some of this compensatory acceleration training or dynamic effort training is going to translate directly to a 1RM. I don't know if we have, you know, concrete data to say that outside of kind of the individualization component. But with the heavier loads, I do think no matter, and I did take a look at this question, if we're saying somebody's more fast twitch or slow twitch dominant fiber type, which is difficult to tell, you could do that on a dynamometer, you could infer that. But aside from that, you could potentially infer that from reps to failure, but the evidence is weak to predict it, so it's hard for somebody to know. I don't know if I would say too concretely either way about dynamic effort work, but I would say with heavier loads, if you're training for strength, maximal intended concentric is how I would almost always train.
All right, good stuff. I'm going to refer someone to some reading literature here. So David asked, so David's going through a mild flu at the moment. Hope you feel better soon. David is taking some Tylenol and is wondering if it's going to affect their gains. I will simply refer you to a paper by Gergic from 2022. What is the effect of Tylenol ingestion on exercise performance, current findings, and future research directions? And I'm using the brand name because, frankly, I don't know how to pronounce the two conflicting generic names. But the PubMed ID is 350-38139. Check that out on PubMed. It's a really nice, even just kind of looking at the abstract, you get a decent lay of the land for this research. But it's a really nice paper that I would encourage you to dig into. Generally speaking, there are some papers hinting at a mild performance improvement effect. I'm not sure about the mechanism. If I had to guess, you know, it may have to do with just pain and effort sensation. But very important to recognize, you know, for someone who has the flu and is saying, I'm taking Tylenol, is this going to hurt my gains? The answer is no. But if someone is thinking, hey, maybe I'm going to take a bunch of Tylenol on a regular basis to modestly improve my performance, I'd file that under bad ideas, Mike. Not a good idea. Tylenol, I can use it whenever I have a headache. It seems to be better for me than like NSAIDs for headaches. But nonetheless, it can be tough on certain gastric tissues. It can, you know, it puts your liver to work. So it's not the type of thing that you want to take as if it's a totally benign. It's not like throwing creatine in your coffee in the morning and saying, eh, what the hell, right? We're talking about taking a medication with known side effects and known risks, especially in the context of high doses and very, very regular usage. All right, Mike, another question for you is this one. We'll see if you can keep it to 2 minutes. This one comes up a lot, so I think just kind of given the summary will work. Is training to failure truly superior? Didn't a recent within subject study showing similar results or show similar results comparing failure to leaving a few reps in the tank? Question mark.
So first, this question is from Wes, who has been in office hours a few times here, or a bunch actually. Wes, appreciate the support, appreciate the questions, always enjoy answering them for you. So this is an excellent question and is one of those that, yeah, it would be tough to keep 2 minutes, but I'll do my best here. So there are a couple of recent studies, an excellent study from Martin Raffalo here. Trex, were you on that? I know Helms was.
I was on the one that Martin did.
Yeah. So, and I believe that was zero RIR versus, a one or two RIR, pretty close to failure. And then there was another study with the within subjects design from Anderson that came out in print recently.
Oh, wait, no, I was on the meta analysis, not the original study.
You were on the meta. Okay. And then there was another study from Anderson that, within subjects design that came out recently. That study was actually published originally online years ago, and I reviewed it in mass, but it just came out in print. I don't know if it's the one you're referring to, but I have had some people message me about it because it did just come out in print now. Now, both of those studies showed no difference between groups or conditions when looking at muscle growth. And the Raffalo study had zero versus about a one or a two RIR, so failure and then really close to failure. The Anderson study maybe had zero RIR, then maybe about three to five, a bit farther. And so I think it's important. One thing about the reason this question has come up a lot over the past years, if we kind of go a little bit back in time, maybe a year or so ago, with the meta regression from Robinson, and that's Zach Robinson. So that was from our lab as my student. And in that meta regression, essentially, it showed that just the directionality without mention specific proximities to failure, we worked very hard not to do that. It just shows that the directionality did show that muscle growth tended to increase as individuals got closer to failure. And I think everybody is probably somewhat aware that I was on record, especially before that time, saying that I thought you could train shy of failure and maximize muscle growth. So essentially, was I wrong on that? And I would still say kind of, I don't know. One thing about the Raffalo paper, and this is a really, really well done study, very well controlled, well-trained individuals. I would definitely recommend reading it. It's done very, very well. But that to my knowledge, the load that was used there was 80% of 1 RM or higher. And in the meta regression, one of the things that we showed was proximity to failure didn't seem to matter when the load was high, because at that point there's a different reason you're already closer to failure. And so it depends on how or why you get closer to failure for it mattering for muscle growth. If you're getting closer to failure with a lower load for all of those other reasons of fatigue that come into play, that's when in the meta regression it seemed to matter, but it didn't seem to matter over 80%. So that could be one of the reasons in the Raffalo study. However, in so many studies, we haven't seen a significant difference. And this was one of the reasons why the results of our meta regression surprised me, which is that I think, and Trex can speak to this, but when you're doing a meta, let's say it's very possible that you could have, a bunch of studies, 30 studies included, not a single one of them is showing a statistically significant difference, but the meta-analysis does. And they could all be leaning in one direction. And when you pool all of the data, it could show an effect size that seems to be meaningful. It could show a p-value if you're using p-values that could be significant. And I think that's what happened in the meta-regression, is that when you go back and look at the individual studies, there wasn't a significant difference, which is why I originally came to the conclusions I had, was that you could probably train a bit farther from failure than most people think. And then, training to failure isn't going to be that big of a deal. But in the meta regression, when you pooled all of that data together, even though individual papers didn't show a significant difference, they were all leaning in that direction. And so the meta shows that there seemed to be a difference there. So now with all of that said, do I actually think there's a difference, or is training to failure actually better? My response would be, I think it's really difficult to say, because then the practical considerations come into account. And if you're going to perform these major lifts, multiple times per week, squats, bench presses, deadlift, should you do all of them to failure all the time? I would say no way. I don't think that's a very practical way to train. I think you could open yourself up to injuries with a technique breakdown. I think it would be difficult to sustain that. And also, when you think of a meta, at least the one that we did, if there was one set to failure, then that counted as failure. So when we say failure, does that mean that all four sets need to be the failure, or is one set sufficient to do the job? And that's something else that I wonder. And then if you do more volume that's not the failure, does that compensate for it? There's so many questions that are unanswered. So for now, I would say my practical recommendations: don't train too much, don't change too much, which is that especially on the main lifts, training within a few reps shy of failure, I think is going to be just fine. I don't really think you're going to be leaving much on the table there. And if you're on your resistance movements, if that's where you want to train to failure, I think that's where you probably go for it, on the bicep curls, tricep extensions, the rows, things like that, and you're good to go. So, what does the absolute data show on this? Yeah, it probably leans in that direction from the results of the meta. Does it change the practical recommendations? And is it actually going to be flesh out that failure is going to be better over the long run for most people on all exercises in all circumstances? I would say no, I don't think so.
All right. Good stuff. Had a question here. Is there anything linking appetite and rest times? I'm deep in a calorie deficit and I'm suddenly less hungry. And the only change I noticed is that I have way longer rest between sets. Now, I'm going to take this one, Mike. Now, generally speaking, the research on the relationship between exercise and hunger or appetite or satiety, which are all technically slightly different things, it's kind of a mess. It's kind of all over the place, and it's because the research can take a lot of different shapes and different formats in terms of how you put a study together. I will say, at least in the acute setting, folks tend to find that one of the key factors that at least is somewhat reliable in this area is exercise intensity. So when people do really high intensity exercise and they're generating all that acidosis and they're generating all that lactate, that seems to attenuate appetite for some number of hours after the exercise is completed. And the only thing I can think of, you know, normally I would say if you wanted to create those conditions to suppress appetite intentionally, you would probably want to, I would think, go with shorter rest periods and do more of like a circuit training type thing to really target that particular, you know, energy system where you're doing a lot of repetitions and short time, short rest, you know, creating that really lactate-forming set of physiological conditions. However, you know, it is possible that maybe by taking longer rest periods, you are digging a little deeper each set. Maybe your total workload over the course of that bout is increasing. Maybe it's having some effect there. So I can't say for sure without getting more details of exactly how your training has changed as these rest periods have gotten larger. This goes against my intuition, but there could be other details that kind of make it a little bit more intuitive once all the pieces come together there. Mike, we are being joined by folks in Durham, North Carolina, Minnesota, Newcastle, Australia. It looks like Leamington, Canada, near Detroit, Sydney, Chicago, LA. We are all over the world right now. And I think we've got probably time for one more. Oh, Poland. How can I forget Poland? I used to have a wrestling singlet with the Polish national crest on it. And I would get questions and comments every time I entered a gymnasium wearing that singlet. Probably one more question here. We had a few that were related to power. If you can translate hypertrophy training to power. A variety of different questions about developing power. So I think maybe if you were someone who was trying to develop power for some particular athletic endeavor, how would you go about training, just kind of a short summary, in order to maximize power production for athletic purposes?
Yeah, so I enjoy this, and I enjoy this question because this actually gets into the reasons I started to get into this field. And I know, Trex, that you and I'd say the two in Mass that have had positions as strength and conditioning coaches.
We've had our hands in the chalk. We've been there. 6 a.m., cup of coffee, yelling, screaming. That's what it's all about.
Yelling, screaming. I was without the coffee. I'm not a coffee drinker because, you know, I like things that don't taste terrible. but we've been there. So I was a strength coach at Salisbury University in Maryland. And before that, I was a strength coach at a high school, actually the high school that I went to. And many, many mornings, super early, like Trek said, screaming at athletes. And that's essentially what that job is. But so if we think of power, you know, just in terms of the most basic definition of power, right, it's defined as work over time. And so we want to put in that work, right, that apply the most force, move it through the displacement, move it through the distance, and do it in the quickest amount of time. And so, you know, I think that power can be somewhat relevant to strength, but I'm not sure how relevant hypertrophy can be to power. There are old data, and you'll find old papers and old textbooks talking about how bigger muscles are going to be able to generate more power. And I'm not saying that that's not true, but that doesn't mean it's the only way to get there. And it's not always advisable past a certain point, because if somebody needs to be really explosive and they're carrying so much muscle, it's going to inhibit them when they're getting out of those starting blocks, right? If you know, a few years ago, a wide receiver for the Seattle Seahawks, DK Metcalf, ran in a 100-meter sprint. I don't know. I'm trying to remember. I don't think it was in the Diamond League tracks. It may have been in a qualifier for something. But he ran a very respectable time, 10-2, 10-3, something like that. But he was so big compared to these sprinters. And he was very fast, and he was very explosive. But he would need to lose a lot of weight, I think, to be competitive with the guys that were you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds lighter running that. And if he lost that weight, I think he'd probably be able to do that. He would have to lose some muscle to do it. And so if I'm training, I am training things where I am moving as quickly as I possibly can, because I want to be able to have high neuromuscular efficiency to be able to overcome a load quickly, to be able to recruit type 2 motor units right away. And if I can do this, I can overcome that heavy load right away. If you can do this, you can get out of the blocks very quickly. So I do think power could help with the other way around by being able to lift a heavy load. But I don't think past a certain point, you're going to want a ton of muscle if you're going to try to get off the blocks in a 100-meter sprint, if you're going to try to jump as high as you can on a basketball court. So I'd be training quickly through these ranges of motion. A lot of times I'd even be, depending on the sport, I'd even be training, let's say, from a dead stop. So if I'm an NFL lineman, you know, rather than doing fly-in sprints, I'm going to do things that are going from that dead stop position, because you're going to have to get out of that dead stop position if you're going to beat, you know, as a defensive end, you're going to beat, you know, the tackle around to get to the quarterback. So being a bit more specific for those sports. So it's always moving quickly through that range of motion.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that, a place where I see a lot of strength coaches lead themselves a bit astray, is they think, okay, power, check, going to move things fast, going to be explosive, and they go straight to the Olympic lifts. And it's not that you necessarily shouldn't, but you have to really think carefully about the athletes you're working with. And the Olympic lifts tend to be very technical in terms of execution. And you may find that if you go all the way to like a fully executed Olympic lift, especially for newer lifters, instead of really developing power, you're developing skill for the lift. That's really the main bottleneck that is limiting performance. And so there are a variety of different variations and adaptations and simplifications of the Olympic lifts that can be really helpful in the weight room, where you eliminate a lot of the technical mastery that's required and get straight to some of the key movements that actually involve the explosive production of just raw power, rather than, like, you know, having your kids trying to like catch a bar in a front rack position in a full front squat position, and that ain't going to work out, right? For the vast majority of especially younger athletes. But yeah, okay, good stuff, Mike. I think you did fantastic with that little speed round, the rapid fire questions. This was an international event, quite the audience tonight, all the way from Canada and the United States, clear across the world into Australia. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. We really appreciate the questions. If you haven't liked the video yet, we are having that issue again that I've been very worried about, where the number of viewers is greater than the number of likes, which is highly problematic. So on your way out, please do be sure to like the video, you know, review, subscribe, all that good stuff. Share it with a friend. Thanks so much for supporting the show. It's been lovely to spend my Wednesday evening with you, but I'm very sleepy, so I will be leaving. I'm sure Mike is as well. I will be back in exactly 1 week. You guys know the drill. Wednesday nights, 7 p.m. Eastern. Everyone have a lovely week, and I will see you soon.